This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Arab Spring ushered in the promise of democracy in Egypt 2 years ago. Recent violence raises questions about the nation's future. The first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, was overthrown by the Egyptian military. Morsi's supporters took to the streets to protest the coup. Hundreds of people have been killed in the violence that followed. In an increasingly interconnected world, the pain is felt everywhere, including right here in North Carolina. Joining us today is Mbai Lo. He's an assistant professor in Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke University. Welcome, Mbai. Good to have you.
Thank you.
You just returned. You have been to Egypt recently and been around the world since then, but have come back. You were there as recently as the beginning of August. What was going on when you left?
I left Egypt at the end of July or on August 5th. And it was interesting. I have been going to Egypt in the last 20 years or so. And as we all know, Egypt is one of the key countries in the Middle East, and if not the most important country in the Arab world. But what I have witnessed this summer is unique in its content intellectually and unique in its progress politically. And among others is what we are talking today right now about the ousting of President Morsi from Egypt and the dramatic events that followed since then.
Do you have any sense that, here is a sort of democracy taking hold? There is an election. There is a lot of passion about the outcome. Obviously, there are winners and losers, and the losers don't like to lose. Any sense on the street about, even if you've lost the election, the imposition of a military coup, the military taking over and undoing the democratic process, even if you lost the election and didn't like the way it turned out, what's the sense on the street that it was that it should have been the military to intervene?
I think we in the West and the U.S. in particular, we focus on the military as a force of evil. I think that is more telling about us than about the Egyptians, where the military, alongside the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Azhar, are the most populous, most legitimate institutions in this country. Remember, you have universal military conscription in Egypt. And you talk about a country where one-third of the population is under 15 years old. And so statistically, the military is everywhere in Egypt, extremely popular. So I think what I enjoy mostly in Egypt, and I have written about it, it made me during my stay in Egypt to go back and read the Federalist Papers and look at Madison's argument about issues of democracy and the challenges that new nations that are trying to adopt democratic measures may face. And I really lived it in Egypt, and I enjoyed it. I think Egyptians, they saw it as such. They didn't they could have called for military coup against Morsi earlier on. But if you read about the so many newspapers in Egypt, and the argument developed was for among all Egyptians, Morsi was democratically elected. We cannot move him the way we moved Mubarak. But one of the most literary leaders in Egypt right now, called Al-Aswani, wrote a paper in which he called Egyptians to come out and support, push Morsi to reorganize his government or call for early presidential elections. His argument was, we don't have a constitution, we don't have a parliament, so we cannot call the military to lead a coup d'etat, but we have rights to collect over 15 million signatures and ask Morsi to review his government. So I think it was democracy at work, and very unfortunate. The killing of innocent people is a criminal act that needs to be investigated locally and internationally. But focusing on coup versus popular unrest, I think, is shallow and unproductive.
Ellen McLarney is with us as well. She is an assistant professor of Arabic literature and culture at Duke. Welcome to the program. Good to
Thank
have you.
You
here. What's your take on this? What's happening to the democratic process and how it's being received in Egypt in these first tender stages of the development of a democracy?
Well, I think it was a moment of, there was a glimmer of hope for the democratic process in Egypt. And I think Egypt has been a beacon culturally, politically, intellectually throughout the region. And when that change came, both in Tunis and in Tunisia and in Egypt, I think it boded well for the region as a whole that there would be massive democratic change that had been anticipated for a long time. And there had been a lot of mobilization for that kind of democratic change for decades. So there was really an infrastructure. I think there has been an infrastructure for such a democratic process within Egypt for a long time. It just has not been implemented because of the authoritarian regime, military regime that has ruled since 1952. So there was a glimmer, there was a moment, and it wasn't a perfect moment. There was a tendency on Morsi's part towards an authoritarianism that was already extant, and people say, in the structure of the state. But he backed down. He really did. He backed down in October 2012, and he did let the democratic process go forward with the vote on the constitution. And there was a vote on the constitution. And it looks like now, with the military taking over, they're not going to want to let a democratic process go forward because the Islamists could come to power again. And then this is just going to be a cyclical bloodshed type of situation.
Well, let's talk about how that's playing out on the ground. Yakin Abdel-Magid is an Egyptian grad student at Duke University in cultural anthropology, and he has just returned from Egypt and on the line with us now. Welcome, Yakin.
Hi.
You're just back from Egypt. Were you in Cairo?
Yeah, actually, I'm just home at Durham now.
Yeah, so tell us what was going on when you left.
It's kind of actually like the death toll, as you can see in the media, and so on is somehow terrible. And there's definitely high levels of violence, and I would say there's lack of any kind of political negotiations or like any thoughts about how to get out of this kind of situation politically without the back of violence from different sides. But it's somehow, of course, depressing, but it also opens many questions about what's going to happen in the future, about how different organizations, movements, ideology would be able to cooperate together for different Egypt, democratic Egypt, if you want. So it's really opens, it throws us back into a very confusing moment about the future of Egypt.
Do you get a sense of what people are thinking about this process, the fact that there's been a coup, even among the opponents of Morsi, who did not want to see him to come to power, who may have violently disagreed with him about the way he was forced out of power?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is like that, like people are like get into political allies in different ways. But like, again, the main problem is that like at some point when violence or crackdowns are like taking place, you find all such kind of alignments and like discussions and negotiations like fall apart. So lots of the pro-Morsi and lots of those who were pro-SCAF changed positions a lot. I know lots of friends who were like pro the army who went into the 30th of June protests and so on. And they shifted positions after what was going on. And I know also lots of pro-Muslim Brotherhood and Islamist kind of groups who also like changed their positions according to what they see and listen to. So it's kind of like a bit confusing right now, but like, again, the point is that there's really, really high level of violence right now, relatively to what has been going on in Egypt the last 2 years.
And Bailo, you said that we're placing too much emphasis on the coup in this and the role of the military. But, you know, from what Yakin is saying, that the violence that has followed is creating confusion now and a certain amount of distrust, a lack of confidence that maybe the democratic process even can work. I mean, what about that aspect of this going forward? Confidence that the hope that democracy offered may be something that was a false dream to begin with.
Well,
No, well, I want to ask Mbai Lo here as our guest as well.
Yeah.
Hey, Yaqin, you're welcome. Well, democracy is never an easy process. It wasn't an easy process in Europe or in the U.S., and I don't think it will be as such in the Arab world, and in Egypt in particular. And Egyptians, I think they're aware of this. I think in my understanding of what was wrong in Egypt is we in the West, the U.S. in particular, we support Egypt, we support developing countries to adopt a democracy, but we don't support them intellectually to deal with issues that may rise with applications of democracy. So in Egypt, I never look at the problem as coup versus popular uprising, because coup d'etat is a political term that even the Muslim Brotherhood reversed to using it because it is appealing to the international world. Likewise, the military also accusing the Muslim Brotherhood of being terrorists is also a technique they use in order to disenfranchise them internally. But neither one was the problem. The problem was an authentic issue in democracy, which is bureaucracy versus democracy, which is accountability versus responsibility, which is rooted in democratic processes. Should Morsi have revert into responsibility, which is look at for the judgment call for the great good of the Egyptian, or should he have reversed it into accountability, which he did, accountability into a constitution? That was the problem.
We explore these programs and problems in greater detail as our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking about the situation in Egypt and its impact right here in the Triangle among people who live and work in this area. Yaqin Abdelmagid is an Egyptian grad student at Duke. He just returned from Cairo. Mbai Lo is assistant professor in Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke. Ellen McLarney is assistant professor of Arabic Literature and Culture at Duke. And joining us now by phone is Samia Sarageldin. She was born and raised in Egypt, now lives in North Carolina. She makes her living as a writer. Welcome back, Samia.
Thank you, Frank. Nice to be here.
You have lots of friends and family in Egypt. What are you hearing from them?
Well, most everyone was very much for the deposing of Morsi. Again, these are the same people who marched against Mubarak for the most part, and also participated in the demonstrations against the military rule, the 18-month interim military rule under the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces that followed the deposing of Mubarak before Morsi took over. So that gives you some idea that it's not people who were necessarily for the military in the first place at all, but they just were completely disillusioned and very, very worried about the direction that the Morsi administration was taking. And almost unanimously now, they are very much for having Morsi ousted, but that doesn't mean that everyone is not heartsick at the violence. Again, the Egyptian media is very pro-military, and I'm not sure they necessarily see the complete picture, although, of course, most of them are constantly on the Internet and view different sources. So it's not like in the days where they would only hear what the state media wanted them to hear. But I think the overriding feeling is that the Morsi regime had to go, that it was extremely dangerous for the country, the path he was going down, and that explains their attitude, which I don't entirely share. I'm delighted to see him gone, but very, very worried by the violence that accompanied that.
Well, let me just ask you this: what you're hearing from, again, the folks in Egypt who you know, maybe many people were happy to see him go. Maybe they felt that he had to go through means that were not democratic. We would call that a coup, a violent blow against the state when you force somebody out without using democratic means. Coup is as good a word as any. Forced out of office without democratic means. So is there a sense then that the that M. Bailot says, well, look, democracies have this kind of uncomfortable stages they go through. This is one of those just uncomfortable moments. But there will be some form of democratic process after all of this. Is there optimism, do you think, from the people you're talking with, that this is just one of those terrible, uncomfortable moments and that Egypt will get through it?
Let me tell you, Frank, to begin with, what the Brotherhood regime, and that's what it was, Morsi was perhaps the figurehead president, but definitely the party bosses were guiding him throughout, and that's something that was well known. The Brotherhood regime was setting in place a system by which democratic means could not have unseated Morsi. In fact, he's been in the process of doing that since November of last year. So the idea that he could have been ousted by democratic means would have been less and less likely as he set more and more fait accompli and the facts on the ground to make it impossible for that to happen. That's one thing. It's not a question of choosing between an authoritarian military regime and a democratic Islamist regime. Both are equally authoritarian and as authoritarian as the Tantawi regime that preceded Morsi and as the Sisi regime that is likely to follow him is going to be. So it's really a choice between what kind of authoritarian. Of course, there is always this optimism that eventually the elusive goal of a democratic regime will happen. And initially, we were all quite hopeful because the team that was put in place, the civilian team, was headed by quite a few competent, respectable, honorable people. And that was inspiring confidence because the Morsi regime was also very incompetent in addition to being ideological.
Yakin, was that some of what you were hearing as well, that this was not going to be the democratic process much longer, and if it wasn't checked now, it would be too late?
I want to second, actually, Mabai's argument that democratic process doesn't have usually a fixed model or a fixed form, and it is usually culturally specific and depends on the situation, the context, and so on. But what is really important to focus on is that also I think this binary can be very problematic between the army and the Islamists because it locks the democratic process and the capacity to develop new democratic form in Egypt into this, like either this or this. And I think this is the trap that lots of social movements, lots of activists, lots of intellectuals in Egypt are trying to get over such kind of binary, basically. And to add, I think that an important aspect of this is how can we find a common language, a shared public space, where we can negotiate all such kind of processes without returning to violence and authoritarian kind of modulations and apparatuses. How can we create this kind of like common language among different kind of ideologies and movements and groups in Egypt? And that's for me the real challenge. And you can, from what I see at least on my Facebook, what my friends' reactions on Facebook, for example, and social networks and so on, is that like they really see things in a very different way through different worldviews, and there's no way to negotiate all such kind of differences.
Yeah. Well, M. Bailot, you were talking about that earlier, the idea that liberals, particularly in the last half of the 20th century, in some ways find it easier to deal with a military regime than with religious fundamentalists when it comes to a process of making a more egalitarian society.
Well, and that is also, if we deal with empirical evidence, that is what we have on the ground. Move to democracy from military-based system is much easier than move to democracy from religious-based system. We ask Iranian or those Palestinian in Gaza or Sudan, and I lived in Sudan for many years, did a lot of research. So having said that, I'm very extremely optimistic about Egypt because Egypt is a unique place. And I think there are so many good things that will the outcome from these events in Egypt, because the military is not coming back in Egypt because they were humiliated last year, as you know. And Sisi, in his speech 2 days ago, he talks about it. He emphasized that they're not coming back because they know that they cannot govern Egypt. That is no one. So the weakness of the Muslim Brotherhood will give opportunity to civil society forces and liberal groups and others to come and fill this gap. So I'm extremely optimistic, and I think the future of Egypt is bright, and from there it may carry on to neighboring countries in the region.
Ellen McLarney?
It seems to me that if it was really the popular will to overthrow Morsi, then that might have been done also, as you mentioned, through a democratic process, even though I agree with Yakin that democratic processes take a myriad of different forms and in different cultural contexts and different historical moments. But there might, I mean, there could have been a process of waiting to vote him out of power. And as Samia mentioned, she said that there was a tendency to, on Morsi's part, to a more authoritarian regime, and that he was putting these policies in place. But Samia, I'm curious, what were these policies that he was putting in place that would make it impossible for democratic transition to happen in the future? I think this tends to be a kind of discourse around the Islamists are incapable of democracy, and that kind of argument was circulated with respect to in Algeria in 1992, and then that justified the overthrowing of the democratically elected Islamist regime there. And similar rhetoric has been circulated in the case of Egypt that the Morsi regime or an Islamic regime or religious regime will be incapable of democracy.
Yeah, Sami, were those policies in place?
Because what were those policies?
There's a lot of I've seen reporting too that this was the constitution itself was a multicultural. It provided a bigger space for women in the culture than we might have expected from an Islamist party. What's the evidence of it?
Okay, so to begin with, Algeria, the Islamic regime there was not given a chance before it was squashed. In Egypt, they had a year. And in that year, Morsi did everything possible. He was checked at certain points and had to draw back. But he tried to completely decapitate the judiciary. They pushed and he had to backtrack. He decapitated the top tier of the military, and they went quietly, to their credit, and bided their time, as we can see. The media clamped down on it completely, put Islamist governors in 9 out of 13 governorships in Egypt, including Luxor, where the tourists don't need a governor who was once part of Jamaa Islamiyya that organized the massacre against the tourists. Morsi railroaded through a constitution that was set only by Islamists because all the other currents in the country boycotted it because they did not want it pushed through in extraordinary 24-hour nighttime sessions. I could go on and on, but I won't, because it's just true. Just one more example. The Minister of Education is a Salafi, which is an extreme Islamist, and he was starting to revise the history of women in Egypt to excise those women that they felt were not good role models in the feminist struggle in Egypt. I will say there is a reason, and I'm not, please understand that I feel that Egypt now is scrambling out of the fire into the frying pan, or it could be scrambling out of the frying pan into the fire. I'm not sure which, so I'm not happy with what's going on. But I do want to say, on behalf of the Egyptians I know who may have voted for Morsi and then were adamant about ousting him, that what they saw is a very real threat, and I saw it too on television. We need to take the Brotherhood and the Morsi supporters at their word. When they were chanting, when they were saying that they would martyr themselves, and more importantly, martyr their children,
Well, you know, but it's interesting. If we look back, and I wonder if this example is appropriate, because in the late 80s, after 30 years of martial rule, free elections were held in Jordan for the first time. This is, again, martial law imposed in the late 50s. 30 years later, under pressure, and there were sort of militant demonstrations in the street that forced King Hussein to allow free elections, and his greatest fear was realized. Both the Islamic Action Front and the Muslim Brotherhood took complete control of the government. Education Ministry was one of the examples. They took control and began to revise history. Women's place in Jordanian culture and economy was marginalized. Within three election cycles, those Islamist parties were voted out of office because the people of Jordan didn't like what they saw. Those Islamist parties looked good and sounded good with their particularly anti-Israeli rhetoric. It all sounded good until they began to make policies that hurt, in a sense, the middle class. Within three cycles, those parties were marginalized. So the democratic process certainly in Jordan did its work to rinse out the extremist effects of fundamentalist parties.
Well, I think we need to put this in a broader context to have a better understanding of it. If you look at the Arab world following World War II, you have three types of system. You have the monarchy system mostly in the Arabia, and you have military dictatorship in many areas in the Arab world, and then you have this type of oligarchy in others. The Arab Spring was against the two, against military systems and those oligarchs. But the monarchy system, they were able to navigate well and successfully passed, and then that is what you see in Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Morocco. In Jordan, though, Jordan is a unique case. It is a country that totally depends on support from the U.S. and Israel and Western European countries. And the king can release his hand, let democratic process prevail, and can remove any opposition leader accusing them of being Palestinian background and take away their citizenship. And I think that is the manner in which this Muslim Brotherhood movement were moved from Jordan to exile in Lebanon or Egypt or in the Western world. But that case, I don't think, can apply in Egypt. Egypt, you talk about this vibrant society that goes back, was modernized by Muhammad Ali Basha in late 18th century and built in a very institutionalized, bureaucratic way. And there is a colleague, a friend, Jalal Amin at American University in Cairo, has written that Egypt cannot move forward without a military participation because it was at the beginning built by military component by Muhammad Ali Basha, great achievement, and later also duplicated by Jamal Abdel Nasser. Also, Jamal Abdel Nasser generally seen as a dictator, but he has tremendously modernized Egypt. The Suez Canal, naturalized by Jamal Abdel Nasser, the great dam of Aswan by Jamal Abdel Nasser. So his argument 2 weeks ago in a Shuruq newspaper was, hey, let us be practical. Look at the military contribution in modern Egypt, which means we cannot move forward without them. We have to incorporate them into a democratic system.
Well, then let's talk about American support for that military, even in the aftermath of the ouster, $1.5 billion or so in aid, the Obama administration considering whether and how to continue that. But this has to be read as support for what goes on or what had gone on in the recent past in Egypt. Ellen, how do you feel about that and America's role in this?
Well, I would like to say something also about the military. I mean, I agree with Mbai on some level that, you know, the military is a popular institution in the sense that there's a lot of popular participation. But then there's the problem right now is that they're being used to massacre the supporters of a political party. And that massacre, by nature of the massacre of these massacres, is a total evisceration of any hope for political participation of the brothers in the future. And they are a very powerful political party in Egypt. And the violent suppression of that party, isn't it going to make any future democratic, peaceful transition possible? Even especially because the military is pushing the brothers into a corner. And with this violence, actually almost trying to provoke them into a violent reaction.
I think politics is the art of making choices. Morsi was a good person, but a very ineffective president, a good Muslim, but I don't think an ideal citizen. He could have made tremendous good choices and move forward. He was given an opportunity seldom given to other leaders. He was, if you look at the numbers, Morsi went in the rerun of, which I lived in Cairo in the last 7 years, all summers in Cairo, since 6 years, in since 2008. During the rerun with Shafiq, Morsi, it was 51 versus 49. Extremely tight. If you look at Egyptians, you have in the last statistics in August 2012, you have 91 million Egyptians. 8 million Egyptians are overseas. And Morsi got over close to 85% of these overseers. So he's the marginal victory he got really came from overseas. That is one. Second is Morsi lost Cairo. If you look at Egypt, is divided into like state-like. We call it governorate. There are 27 governorates in Egypt. And you have three major governorates in what we call the Greater Cairo. You have Cairo, Morsi lost Cairo. You have Giza, Morsi lost Giza, and you have Al-Sharqiyah. So Morsi lost Cairo, basically.
It's hard to know where that support comes from. We are out of time, and I'm sorry to say that, but I want to thank all of you for being on our program. Mbai Lo is an assistant professor in the Asian and Middle Eastern Studies Department at Duke University. Ellen McClarney, an assistant professor of Arabic Literature and Culture at Duke. Samia Sarageldin is born and raised in Egypt and now lives in North Carolina. She is a writer. Yakin Abdel Magid is an Egyptian grad student at Duke. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, we talked to North Carolina Senator Ellie Kennard about her decision to resign from office. Stay with us on The State of Things.